This episode is brought to you in part by Litvin School of Mission, Ministry, and Leadership at Wheaton College. Our graduate programs in evangelism, ministry, and leadership enrich your mind, spirit, vocation, and character to refine what's already within you. Learn more at wheaton.edu/CT.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you in part by Brotherhood Mutual Insurance Company, a ministry-focused insurance and payroll provider serving Christian churches, schools, and related ministries. For more information, visit brotherhoodmutual.com.
Today is May 1st, and you're listening to Quick to Listen, where we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. And today we will be talking about the state of Christianity in France, one of the world's most secular countries. I'm Morgan Lee, digital media producer here at Christianity Today. I am joined by my co-host, Mark Galley. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Good to be in warm Chicago.
Absolutely.
I'll foreshadow my precious moment in that I left Denver and it was 31 degrees and snowing.
Oh, wow. You have something nice to say about the weather here. That exactly. Is a great thing. I'm happy to hear that. All right. So who are we talking to?
This morning, we're talking to Raphael Anzenberger. He is director of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries for the French-speaking world, president of France Evangelization, and adjunct professor of intercultural studies at Columbia International University in the United States. Welcome, Raphael.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us. Maybe you can tell our listeners where you're calling us from, where you live.
I live in Nice now on the French Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lovely place, and you need to come and visit.
Yeah, that's a nice place to suffer for the Lord.
So what do you see when you look outside? Is there like, do you see a body of water? Is it beautiful?
Yeah, well, and we have nice offices, but not to this point. I mean, we have to be reasonable within the budget. You know?
Exactly.
That's not fair.
Every ministry has to be reasonable within a budget. Yeah.
It's okay. Well, we look out our office and see water sometimes too. It's usually after there's been a lot of rain.
Exactly.
Then it pools in the parking lot. Well, let's kind of give people a sense of why we are discussing this topic today. As most people know, 2 weeks ago, the Notre Dame caught fire and burned, not to the ground, but the damage was so severe that some have suggested that the church may not reopen for up to 5 years. As efforts to raise money to rebuild the famous Paris Cathedral have commenced, it's catalyzed a larger discussion about the state of Christianity in this officially secular country. So last year, Pew Research Center did a big report on the state of religion in Western Europe, and I thought I'd just kind of go over the French religious breakdown that they found. So they saw in their research that when they looked at the population, 18% of the population were church-attending Christians. 47% of the population, so almost half, were non-practicing Christians. 22% of the population was not religiously affiliated, and 8% was a different religion, or they said they did not know. So a month prior to the Notre Dame fire, Newsweek published this article. It said, Catholic churches are being desecrated across France and officials don't know why. And I just wanted to read a couple lines from this particular report. It said, France has seen a spate of attacks against Catholic churches since the start of the year, vandalism that has included arson and desecration. Vandals have smashed statues, knocked down tabernacles, scattered or destroyed the Eucharist and torn down crosses, sparking fears of a rise of anti-Catholic sentiment in the country. So that's also kind of happening, you know, against this other context of the fire in Notre Dame, which there's no reason to think that this has been caused by vandalism, but obviously these things have all happened in a short period of time. So concurrent to all of this, France continues to welcome immigrants, be they Christians or Muslims who practice their faith often much more robustly than the local population. And so this week on Quick to Listen, we wanted to discuss the state of Christianity and, of course, more specifically, the evangelical movement in one of the world's more secular countries and what the aftermath of the Notre Dame blaze reveals about religion in France. So, Mark, I think we should just do our gut check about this particular fire that happened a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, the main gut check was as was to be expected, but it still was disappointing. It's understandable and disappointing in that when the fire, when Notre Dame was described by journalists, it was described as an icon of the French people or the country of France. For a while, people seemed to forget that it was a building built to honor our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It was a church.
And Mary. Hello, the
and
name. Mary.
Well, there you go. And Mary, exactly. That was the main thing. But, you know, like most people, it is something special to France. There's no question about that. But given the worldwide reaction to it, I was surprised that it seems to be iconic for the whole world in a lot of ways.
Yeah, when you were saying that, I thought that was an interesting point because the day before that it burned, it was Palm Sunday, and they actually had Palm Sunday services in there. And presumably they were going to have a number of other Holy Week services that were going to play out there. But I actually think that that speaks to kind of attention that I'm assuming we're going to get into about a country that sees itself as secular. But when people think of like what really seems to epitomize it, one of the things that they pick is a church.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And so why is that? You know, what is this kind of like bleeding together of these two things that's happening?
And when I think of a country that's supposedly secular, I don't think of a country in which 18% of the church population is attending church and another 40% still consider themselves Christians but non-practicing. So I'm looking forward to getting into that with Raphael.
Yeah.
It seems more religious than I imagined it to be.
Raphael, do you want to give us your reaction when you found out that there had been this big fire that had happened?
Yeah, it was very interesting indeed to see the reaction of people in France. And it's true that you had on one side those who mourn the fact that it was a place of worship, the Catholics mainly. And then often noticed that the media or even the French president, when he addressed the nation the day after, didn't mention the Catholics. And then another segment of the population, which is the largest segment, who remembers Notre Dame as a place not just for religious activity, but also that had inspired movies, cultures, a cultural icon, a reference point when everybody visit Paris, so you have to go through Notre Dame. And so in a sense, Notre Dame has this dual heritage. It's a spiritual heritage, but it's also a very strong cultural heritage. So we can understand why, you know, some people would choose to emphasize one rather than the other.
So obviously I read these numbers at the beginning of the show, and I kind of wanted to revisit them because Mark mentioned them as well in his gut check. So I don't expect any of our listeners to remember these off the top of their head, so I'm just going to go through them again. So it found that there were 18% of the population were church attending Christians, as 47% of the population was non-practicing Christians, 22% was religiously unaffiliated, and 8% was other religion, or they said they didn't know. So Raphael, when you see these numbers, do you find them surprising or kind of consistent with what your experience has been in France?
Well, when it comes to numbers and statistics, it really depends the way you actually count. We're using a little bit of different statistics range, which I think will speak better for those who are listening to the podcast. Usually what we say is that 1 out of 10 French people is going to church on any given Sunday. So that makes 10% of the population. And that is roughly 6% Catholic, practicing Catholic Christians. You add on the top of that 3% Protestants, which will include evangelicalism and Pentecostalism, and then Orthodox. So basically within the tradition, the Christian tradition faith, and you get to 10%. So 1 out of 10 French person is going to church on a Sunday, and now 9 out of 10 either stay in bed or do something else. That's pretty much the way we talk about church attendance today.
Yeah, it could be. Often when they do church attendance in American polls, have you attended church once in the last month or twice in the last month? So that would explain the disparity. But your stat seems more realistic in terms of how it's felt week to week.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, still 54% of the French people would identify themselves as Catholics. But when you actually dig into that, there's at least 9 different tribes within Catholicism. But the bulk part is actually social or cultural Catholicism. Those who would subscribe to the Catholic faith and understand actually what they're talking about, that's more in the 6%. And I've even seen recently another figure of 4%. which would signify that the number is still dropping in number of people attending church. And I guess, the recent scandals in the Catholic Church have not helped too much the perception of the French people over, the relevance of the Catholic Church.
So what I found interesting about how Pew kind of had this taxonomy of different groups that they were surveying was that they had non-practicing Christians. And I know you said that there's even greater variance in how you've studied this, but maybe you could talk to us a little bit about the ways that Catholic identity is understood and experienced, even if it's not necessarily practiced in the way that we like think of faith being particularly practiced.
So usually what you will find is a split among generations. So if we want to really call it like this, if you take 50% up, those would be Catholics who have been raised Catholics. And so they would define themselves as Catholics. And when you ask them what they mean by that, it means that they were baptized or they had their children baptized in a church. They were usually married in a church, and they surely hope to be buried in a church. Then when you ask the 30-50, this is a generation that needs to remember if they were raised Catholics or not. So that's still a remote souvenir in a sense. And they're not really sure why their parents asked them to be that, because they will say that their parents are not really that religious. So that proportion is questioning really if they're Catholics or what actually means to be Catholic. And then if you take the 30 years old and under, that's where you will find more a militant generation, those who attend the Catholic youth event a day is very popular. Those who will go to Teze community, those who will have a regular pilgrimage to different places of worship. And usually those are militant in a sense that they abide by the Catholic faith and the sacraments and the tradition. So that's broadly how I would see the split when you look at the different generations.
It's interesting because when I saw news photos of people praying on their knees as the cathedral was burning, most of the people were young that were doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. This is surprising, but if you go to Paris on Sunday evenings, you have a lot of Catholic churches who are putting together special events for youth, and it's there. I mean, the Catholic youth is very much militant in a sense, and it's interesting to see that they are being also inspired by the evangelical church in the way they express their faith. The kind of worship that they are bringing to the church, the way they do evangelism and missions, and it's almost sometimes difficult to see if they are actually Catholics or evangelicals.
That's very interesting. That parallels some things that are going on in the States. I attended a couple midweek Catholic outreaches because I knew people who were speaking at them, and the tone of the meeting was just like you described. If you didn't know better, you'd say you were in a charismatic evangelical gathering to listen to someone talk about abortion. It was just quite interesting to me.
Yeah, you see the same phenomenon in Poland, for instance, where the youth is very much active in the Catholic Church, and it's sort of a rebirth. But it's not coming out of tradition. It's really coming out of faith in the credos of the church.
So I'm curious because, at one point, obviously, most of the French population, an overwhelming amount of the French population, would have identified really robustly as Christian or Catholic. And so was there a particular point in the last 50 to 75 years where that type of level of enthusiasm really began to wane? And could you give us some of the context for why you think that happened?
One thing that is a little bit difficult for the listeners coming from North America to understand the state of the church in Europe is the fact that when America was birthed, it was decided not to have any state church, but from the very beginning to offer a pluralistic understanding of how religion could be practiced. That's why the rise of denominations is quite recent in church history, and it's actually North America that has given that to the world. But only until very recently, European countries were defined or are still in some places defined by a state church. So in Germany, this is a Lutheran church. In Norway, Sweden, you have state church. In the UK, you have the Anglican church. And in France, it was the Catholic church, like it was in Italy and Portugal and Poland. So being Portuguese or being Polish or being French equals you belong. And you're born within the state church, and the church sponsors the state and vice versa. So it's very difficult for Europeans who were born in a state church to imagine that there's actually a reality beyond the state church religion. And that's why for a lot of French people, there's nothing beyond being Catholic. And if you say even the word Protestant, they might have some vague souvenir, but for them, the Protestants are in Switzerland and they're not necessarily in France. And that's very important for our listeners to understand, and that makes it difficult. But to answer your question, I'd say that the split started in the 18th century for multiple reasons. Number one, it was the way wars were raging throughout Europe between Protestants and Catholics. And at some point, it became really difficult for people to envision actually building a society on a religious ground. Okay, who do we trust, and which confession do we follow? So that was difficult. That's why the rise of deism was perceived as a better option already in the 18th, 19th century. That if we can all agree that there is a first mover, there's a great architect, and that would be the definition of God, and this would be removed from any church tradition or religious definition, then maybe this would be the start of something that we can build on. And that was at the core of the Freemason enterprise in the 18th century. And with that, it was fueled in the field of philosophy with the Enlightenment, of course, and the rise of subjectivism, the idea that actually I can exist beyond a cosmos, beyond a society that is regulated by order, and I can exist for myself. I can have a personal opinion, and it can be different than the one that is perceived as to be the norm by society. And when you look at the trajectory in France, there was a definite split in the early 20th century, especially in 1905, when there was a strict separation between church and state through a law that we call the law of laïcité. And you have probably heard that word somewhere, somehow, through the media, and that said that it was pretty much the end of the story for the Catholic Church in terms of running the school system, running the hospitals, being involved in the public life, even the political life. 1905 was a definite divorce, a bad divorce, I might say. And then overnight in 1906, you had two splits. You had a split and two Frances, pretty much. You had the Catholic Church, which deemed that the Pope was actually the ruler, and then you had the Republic of France, where the Republic was the ruler. And it took basically till 1970 to bring back some sort of peace in this couple between the Catholic Church and the French Republic. We're still dealing with the aftermath of it, but 1905 was a very bad divorce, if I must say.
My memory says there's also has been a tremendous amount of resentment against the Catholic Church in France for various and sundry reasons. Was that part of the reason for the ugly divorce?
You really had a split. I mean, it was half-half. Half of the French people couldn't believe that you could be actually French without being Catholic. Okay. So for them, it was like Quebec. In a sense, it was an identity that was rooted in religion and politics. And then for the other half, they wanted to be free of doing other things and exploring other things. And actually the Protestants, along with the Freemasons and the Freethinkers, were the ones who actually petitioned for a strong divorce.
Oh, okay.
And in a sense, it needed to be said to the Catholic Church, we need to move into something that is different. And the Catholic Church couldn't envision actually operating differently. That's why the divorce was such a difficult deal, because on the Catholic side, they were not at all pleased with the way things were going. It was not an agreed position that we had to move into a pluralistic society. France was still considered to be the daughter of the Catholic Church, and as such had to remain under the authority somewhere, somehow, of Rome.
Wow, that's a really great understanding and makes sense about why there's so much disconnection, I guess, from the Catholic Church today, if there was that much fighting that was going on for so long.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you in part by the MA in Humanitarian and Disaster Leadership Program at Wheaton College Graduate School, preparing leaders to serve the most vulnerable and the church globally. I spoke with Jamie Ayton, founder and executive director of the Humanitarian Disaster Institute. Jamie, so a student becomes a part of this program and they're not waiting until the end of the program to sort of get involved in this kind of help?
No, actually, just this morning I met before our classes with a small group of our students who are going to be helping lead some teams in Puerto Rico over spring break for the recovery process there. Our teams are typically a combination of students and faculty and staff. Our team's also deployed, for example, to the Philippines and Japan and Haiti. One of my colleagues right now is actually in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, where she's helping to provide, and the rest of our team who's there, providing trauma training to some of the refugee pastors so that they can better care for members in the camp.
For more information, go to wheaton.edu/HDL.
So I want to actually go back to what we were talking about in the aftermath of the fire at the Notre Dame. When Macron or some of these other leaders are talking about it, do they feel like they need to be careful with how they talk about things like this in light of all the history that you just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, for practically one century, pretty much throughout the 20th century, you had to be, as a political figure, you had to be very, very careful and not to identify yourself with the Catholic Church. That doesn't mean that you had to be an atheist to be leading the country. Like Charles de Gaulle was a great president, a great general, and he was a devoted Catholic, but he would not go to the Mass on Sunday. He would only go to the Mass whenever he would be back in his own parish, or he would take communion in a private setting. So from that point on, it was very important that the leader, the political, the public figure of the Republic would abstain from actually identifying itself to a church tradition. I must say that with already with Sarkozy and also with Macron now, we're moving into a second stage of secularization, I'd say. In the first stage, especially the 20th century, the role of the state was to keep the Catholic Church at bay, in a sense, far from any relationship or influence on the political scene. Now we're moving into a second phase, which I would call the post-secular phase. And that is the state sees itself now as a referee more. Because, again, if you take the number of practicing Catholics, if you take the 6% figure or the 4%, a more recent figure, it's no longer a threat to the government. You add that the 3% Protestants, you add on the top of it roughly 5% practicing Muslims. And so what you end up is actually you have militant minorities who are actually asking the right to express their faith in the public square. And then the state has to shift from being the protector of the Republic to be actually a referee in facilitating the way religious minorities can express themselves in the public square. And that's a very, very new dynamic that we see in politics. And Macron especially is very open to that kind of dialogue and is asking actually the state to be more conducive and fruitful in the conversation with the religion tradition rather than just ignoring them altogether.
Again, remind me if my memory of news stories is faulty, but it does seem like when we hear stories of how European countries are dealing with Muslims particularly and how they want to express their faith by wearing head coverings and such, that France, my impression is France seems to have little patience with that sort of thing. Is that a correct impression?
Well, you have to remember that France has the largest Muslim community and the largest Jewish community in Europe. So we have to, you know, that's why whenever there's a political tension in the Middle East, in the Israelo-Palestinian conflict, there's direct correlation in our suburbs. And so the Muslim community tends to be very pro-Palestinian. And of course, you know, the Jewish community tends to be pro-Israel. So it's a tough place for the government to be in because they have to keep those two minorities at peace with one another. It has to use great care in the way we are dealing with Islam. And I think the government is right in considering that not all Muslims are radicals, that Wahhabism and Salafism is only one of the four strands of Islam. Actually, most of the Muslims in France are very peaceful. And they would abide more to a folk Islam coming from North Africa than a more radical Salafi. We see the complexity of trying to even bring the Muslims together to form sort of a council of Muslims of France that could speak of one voice. And when you look at the different trends and within Islam, they even have a hard time coming together around the table. There's the Moroccan trend, there's the Algerian trend, the Egyptian trend, the Saudi trend, and it's different. It's not a monolithic segment. It's multiple traditions and multiple voices, which adds to the complexity of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we get into more about Islam, because I do want to talk about that and immigration in general in France and how that's affected things, I did want to just ask you about the vandalism story that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. How has that been received in France? Are people aware that this is happening? Is this something that you think is a big deal, or is just, you know, small incidences happening that are probably, I don't know, the result of local anger, but not necessarily symbolic of something larger that's happening?
Well, I mean, you're right in a sense that there's something new. If you look at the numbers of vandalism acts, it's on the rise, and it does raise the question why is it so? Now you have to remember there's 22,000 Catholic place of worship in the country. Most of them are empty. Because when you have a parish with 9 or 10 villages, you have to regroup all the worship into one or two places. And so the Catholic Church is really stretched. To give you just a figure, they've ordained a little bit more than 150 priests last year. And that's to take care of 22,000 congregations. So you can see the difficulty and the need of the Catholic Church actually to request help from Africa and Asia in terms of priesthood to be able to fill up the gap. A lot of the Catholic building are just run down buildings, and so people come and squat them, and they think they can do everything they can or they want in those places. Other, which is not the majority, I think, are political statements, or also the work of satanic cults. That you know, they're very keen on breaking into the church and then finding the Holy Sacrament, and then use that for their own ceremonies.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yes. So you have those a lot, especially in the center of France and in the West.
All right, let's talk about immigration to France. Maybe you can just tell us right now what countries are the majority of immigrants who come to France. Where are they from?
So we had different waves of immigration throughout the centuries. We had waves of immigration from Africa, of course, from the Caribbeans, then in the 20th century from North Africa, from Italy, from Portugal. And then we have new waves of migrants coming through the Middle East and East Africa, West Africa. So those would be migrants from Syria, from Iran. We have a large number of Iranians also coming in, but also from Ethiopia, from Eritrea, from Congo, from Mauritania, from Libya. So those would be more recent waves of migrants. So because Europe is we call it the Schengen space. So if you enter into one of the European countries, you can actually be very mobile once you have your paperwork. Usually migrants will not stay in France, especially the new migrants. They would rather actually go to the UK. Because the UK society is more multi-community driven, it's more multicultural, and so you can move to Birmingham, for instance, and be an Afghan or be a Pakistani and not even speak a word of English, and you still have a work, and you can still function in France. If you don't learn the language, then that's it. You cannot actually integrate into society. So it's very difficult for migrants to make it to France because the level of integration which is required by the state is so high that often the migrants will choose another country. And then also we have 9% unemployment. So we have a stock of unemployment which is really high. So it's very difficult for them to find any sort of employment. So they tend to go through and not stay.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying and sirens go off and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
Are many of the migrants who are either coming in now or who have been here for several decades, are many of them Christians?
Well, those coming from Syria usually are from a Catholic tradition, and so they are very much welcomed by the Catholic churches in our country, and many have found sheltered among the Catholic communities. Then you have those coming from Congo. They are usually evangelicals, and they do sometimes end up in our communities. And then you have those, which is the bulk part, coming from Muslim background. And those either they stay or they tend to go to the UK or Germany, where there's more employment opportunities.
So can you tell us a little bit about the outreach that the evangelical churches that you have worked with or attended have done with these immigrant populations?
Well, I must say that, let's put it this way. I wish I would have some great stories to tell you. But the reality of the fact is that the French Evangelical Church, which is roughly 2,300 churches total in the country, last time I counted, which is basically what you will find in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Okay.
Wow.
That's what we have for 66 million people. So you do the ratio. We have a church for every 32,000 inhabitants. And that means that there's still a long way to go. And the evangelical church is still not totally missional in its thinking and very much preoccupied to be able to survive, especially in rural areas. We have issues with the ability to form a new generation to take over the existing churches. At the same time, we want to plant more churches. But about reaching out to the migrants, let's say that we praise the Lord for American missionaries who are willing to come and stay amongst us with a full-blown salary, and they really have a heart for that. It's changing, especially among the new generation. We see some great ministries in the West or in the North, some in the South, younger generations who are refusing to follow the pattern of the classical evangelical church, to think that it should be somebody else's problem. it's changing a little bit, but we're still far from actually embracing, in a sense, the opportunity that is in front of us. And I really much regret that state.
So that, in terms of reaching out to immigrant communities, you're saying the church, evangelical church, doesn't do a great job of that. But are there concerted efforts to reach out to the French population in general? I mean, your whole ministry is based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, maybe the listeners will be surprised to hear that currently we're opening a church every 10 days in France, make the evangelical faith the fastest growing religious segment in France.
So you're basically reaching out to disaffected Catholics and people who have lost all touch with religion.
Yeah, those who call themselves Catholics and can't remember why. In a sense, so the distance is really far out. But we're also, I mean, to be fair, I would say that the majority of the French population is agnostic. You know, they will. We always had a sort of a core structural atheism stock that we would be glad to ship to the States at some point in time if you want some more. But it never really reached beyond 15%, you know, 15%. And they're very vocal, but they don't get any traction. So the majority, the two-third majority of the French population is agnostic, soft agnostic, hard agnostic. So it's different in terms of evangelism than it's actually convincing a Catholic that they need to change their faith, or an atheist that he needs to give up his atheistic. It's more about presenting the God that they think is there, but they don't know how to get to him.
So what does your ministry actually look like? Maybe you can tell us about its strategy, philosophy, and approach to trying to reach this population.
Well, within the Ravi Zacharias ministry, we are keen on reaching the cultural influencers. That's really where our heart is. And in France, that means, we're trying to reach out to those who are in the field of politics and business, but also in the fashion industry. There's very few things done in the fashion industry. And if we have any listeners interested in evangelism in the fashion industry, I would be very happy to be in touch with them, because that's a segment, sociological segments that is really in need of the gospel. And we have, of course, New York, but we have, you know, London and Paris and Milan were the big places for the fashion industry. So we want to reach out also to that segment, those in also in the fields of arts. And then in terms of other ministries like France Evangelization, what we're trying to do is we educate the local church about the role of the ministry of the evangelist. And we say that God, through the sovereignty that is His, is still raising up evangelists in the local church. And we are very happy as a ministry to come alongside the local church and equip their evangelists in their midst, so that they can actually then in turn equip the saints to give a reasonable answer to the questions that people are asking about their faith. So we're both an evangelistic ministry, but also we're equipping the church through evangelists to be better at being missionally driven.
Yeah, it brought smiles to our faces to think about reaching out to the fashion industry. But if the depictions in the media of life in the fashion industry, it would strike me that it would be a fertile ground for evangelism. There's a lot of insecurity, and it's an environment that can really be brutal to people.
Absolutely, it's tremendous. It's a business. It's an industry that is geared around the idea of image. But you think about it, the first designer was God.
Yes.
So he knows. He knows about design. He knows about image. He knows about covering, and in a sense, humans are very different than animals, because they're the only one who dress. So why do we dress? Why do we feel the urge, number one, to create, and second, to create something to cover something? So it's actually crazy to see the different. I mean, the multiple bridges. Natural bridges in the conversation for the gospel, and we've seen people very hungry to look at identity, issues of identity and image, and we use the Imago Dei, the image of God conversation, to bring them to the point of realizing that what they're seeking through their craft is actually the God, the designer.
when you're talking about these churches that are, these evangelical churches that are in France, are they more likely to be in the major urban areas or are they out in the countryside?
We have both. We have both in the rural and in the cities. I think where the church is not right now, it's really in the heart of big metropolitan centers like Paris and Lyon and not Marseille. Two reasons. Number one, it's very expensive to live there, and so it's very complicated to rent a place of worship and to live in the heart of a city. You have to remember that in Europe, rich people live downtown and poor people live in a suburb, which is different than it is in the States. If you take San Francisco or New Orleans, you have a better understanding the way our European cities are built. So we have a hard time now penetrating really the heart of the cities. And the second reason why it is difficult beyond just the price tag, it's because we still don't have the how to behave in a society. You know, for so many centuries and years, we were a persecuted minority, that it's only very recently that we are perceived to be something credible, almost an alternative, a credible alternative to Catholicism. So we have to learn to exist in society the way we've always felt society was an enemy, in a sense. So it's a learning curve for us. We only have very recently MPs who are evangelicals or senators who are evangelicals, those in the field of academia. It's very, very new. And it's great to see this younger generation wanting also to influence society.
So I think what you're saying is that for a long time, evangelicalism just hasn't had this type of cultural cachet or respectability. And I'm sure, like many things, it also has a reputation that's influenced very broadly by American evangelicals as well.
Which is good and bad. I mean, depends who is in power, right? But I remember when George Bush went to war against Iraq, there was one of the big, the equivalent of the Newsweek magazine, if you say, that had a big cover up, you know, Bush is heading the evangelical cult who wants to conquer the world. A lot of media actually came to see us and say, oh, okay, so how come you are working for the American government? Are you CIA? So,
oh, wow.
And it took us about 10 years, you know, through very heavy communication to sort of draw a distance to the American policy to say, yeah, no, there, you know, we actually, if you look back through history, we're Europeans first.
in the 18th century. Yeah.
So in a sense, we were there before America was born. But at the same time, let me tell you how much I'm thankful for the American church. You know, in my tradition, 70% of the churches that were planted in France were planted because of foreign missions, and Americans have been the bulk part of this effort of missionary endeavor. And I can only be thankful for the so many lives who decided to come and do the work and learn the language, live their country, and love my people. So I'm not the one who's going to say anything negative about Americans.
You can say one or two negative things. It's okay. You know us.
Now, that's the report I hear from many Christians in other countries as well. We do tend to be, as well we should be, a little self-critical of our own efforts and how we could have been better missionaries in the past and how we can be better missionaries in the present. But I'm always, when I do ask people on the ground in other countries that have a strong Christian presence due to mostly American missionaries, they're fundamentally grateful for the efforts that were taken.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we still have, as a national church, a lot to learn. And I really believe that the maturity of any given country is its propensity to send its best people, men and women, for kingdom's sake to the nations.
So one of the biggest stories that's come out of France in the past 6 months has been the Gilets Jaunes protests. And I didn't know to the extent that those protests have at all intersected with any of the work that either the Catholic Church and also the Evangelical Church is doing.
Well, it was not really related or correlated at any point. I think the Gilets Jaunes was a multi-level conversation. That's why it's still today difficult to say who is a Gilets Jaunes, who is not a Gilets Jaunes. I think today the Gilets Jaunes is more the story of some extremist groups, anarchist left-wing groups who are trying to topple the government. And so they're adding a lot of confusion in the story. But the early Gilets Jaunes were the middle class and lower class who were expressing the fact that they were paying too much tax. And France is a welfare country. It's a socialist country and requires a lot of tax to run the government. And it's true that at some point it became really very difficult for some of the families, especially women raising children alone, to be able to end the month in the black. And so it was just a profound frustration with the tax level in the government. And I think the government responded last week to that very preoccupation. So I believe that the Gilets Jaunes will fade out. And the only ones who will continue to militant are usually more on the left wing extremist side, and they want to redefine what the Republic is all about.
You might want to translate that into English for how journalists here translate that.
Oh, the Yellow Jackets?
The Yellow Jackets, thank you.
That's fair. One thing I think that is interesting, though, is that when you live in these countries that are welfare states in many ways, I think people's experiences of the church is different than in the United States, right? Lots of people experience the church through social services here in the U.S. because the government does not provide nearly as much. And so to some extent, there's not as much of an entry point sometimes for the church to be able to play a role in people's lives. Not like that's a bad thing. That's just a different thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I mean, 1905 was definitely, the end of the supremacy of the Catholic Church in the field of education and the medical field. And so you also have in France a strong tradition of free association, those what we call 1901 association. And many actually are doing social work. But the bulk part actually is the government's role, is to take care of the elderly and the poor. And then the free association and the church do their part. But a welfare system is, there's only one who is responsible for even the bad weather. It's called the president. And, you can find his phone number on the White House
hotline. There you go. Exactly.
So having said that, then, what are the issues that are really important to the French evangelical community?
I think one of the main issues we're having right now is finding new places of worship. Really, it's getting complicated. Again, we're opening a church every 10 days, and that's a net figure. That means it's all the ones that we're opening minus the ones we're closing. So it's a net figure.
Wow.
So that means that we need to find new places of worship. At the same time, those smaller congregations we had are growing, which is a sign of health, and many are doing building renovations, and that requires special legislation for that. And so part of the beauty of being French is to be very, very complicated when it comes to legislation. I don't know why, but it's almost like we invented, administration headaches. And we're very, very good about that. And so it's getting really complicated for our pastors, who not only need to feed the flock, which is their first calling, but also to be experts in handicap law, into fireproof building, you have to be a lawyer, a notary. It's just crazy. An architect. It's very, very complex, and the administration is not helping, because sometimes what they'll say is, we really like you. We understand. We think we understand who you are. We think we understand you're not a cult, which is already a good progress. But then they'll say, if we help you, then we'll need to help all the other ones. And the other ones is basically the Muslims. And so do we want to do that? Do we want to help you? Because then they'll come and say, hey, you have the evangelicals. Then what about our prayer room? What about our mosque? And so that's where it becomes really complicated with political figures.
Wait, so why would France not want to help, or why would it not want to make it easier for all religious groups to be able to open up new religious spaces?
That's a very good question. Yeah, so that's part of the complexity to move from a place in the 20th century where the enemy was the Catholic Church to a place now where we have to reinvent religious discourse in a public square, but with militant minorities, because the Catholics, they want something, the evangelicals, they want something, the Muslims want something. The Jews want something. And so and some of the political figures today, they have no clue how to actually navigate in this new field of pluralism. What does that mean for the government to be a referee in that? And it's so it defaults back into the position where we have to defend the sanctity of the republic.
Hmm.
But at the same time, that's not what the law said. The law says you have to guarantee that it's actually happening. And so we continue to have back and forth conversation with members of the government. And we've done quite a number of publications with the National Council of French Evangelicals on that very topic, on what does it mean to be a République laïque, and what is the proper place of religion in a public square. But there's still so much to do, and especially in the heads and the hearts of those who are elected for public service. They still need to ramp up to the idea that it is legitimate today in 21st century France to be an evangelical and to have a voice in the public square.
So obviously we have an issue with empty churches here in the U.S., just like you in France. You guys in France have lots of empty churches. And at least in my experience in Chicago, I've seen a number of these turn into all different types of things, including the place that I do circus at is a former church. Most of them, of course, get turned into buildings where people end up living. Some of them turn into community centers. I'm not sure if any Catholic churches turn into Protestant churches. Presumably they do, but I don't know that I've seen that. But has there been any conversation about turning any of these empty Catholic churches into Protestant churches or to mosques or synagogues?
Well, one thing for sure is that the church can become a circus, and I've been a pastor, and I tell you that it's often more the case than it is not. So
that makes perfect sense for your circus to meet in the church.
Yeah, there's a partnership to do here. But to answer your question, it's interesting, and to pick back the conversation on Notre Dame. It is okay for the French person to see a Catholic church being turned into a cultural center, and most will become a cultural center, a place for artists to express their arts. One or two times there were questions about Muslims buying Catholic churches to make them places of worship, and that did not go well at all, and especially the extreme right. Raise the funds to be able to secure actually the premises so that the Muslims would not actually buy it. That's still very much a very sensitive and nationalistic agenda. And so I don't think we'll see that happening. Now, when it comes to the evangelical churches, some Catholic churches are selling their premises for a fortune, number one. And two, when you look at actually the state of the church, the way it's actually run down, it is so cost, massive cost in terms of maintenance, that it will kill us. We don't have the financial backbone to be actually able to restore them to their proper measure. So we're seeing a trend for some hotels to actually invest in those places of worship, but usually the people who will do that, they will respect in a sense the tradition that was there, and when they do it, they do it with elegance, which is nice.
Which is part of the DNA of France. If you're going to do something, do it with elegance.
There we go.
I will say that, like, you know, American evangelicals do put churches in schools, and I go to house churches. I don't know if those are options that are on the table for the evangelical community when it opens new churches too. But
well, it's difficult to have access to schools because they're majority public schools, and the Catholic schools are not that eager for us.
But you guys can't meet in public schools?
No, we can't. No, that's just strict separation. Of church and state, so that wouldn't be possible. So usually what happens is we find a business And then we just rent the place. That's usually the way it happens.
Huh.
Or we build, but when we have to build, we will have to build outside of the city, which means that we lack then the cultural influence that we could have if we would be in the heart of a city.
All right. So my next question is, how can we pray for the French Evangelical Church? And it sounds like zoning.
In a sense, we're growing, and that's a happy thing. Again, a church every 10 days. The low figure is 650,000 evangelicals in France. I believe we're more now into the 1 million. There's also the rise of a new generation who is taking a strong stand for their faith in the fields of politics and business and the fashion industry and the arts. So that's really topics of rejoicing. So we can celebrate for that. But we can also pray that, this verse, to whom it has been given much will be required. For many years, France has been the recipient of missionary generosity, especially coming from America. I think it's time for France to turn around and start to give to other nations. When I see the need in North Africa, in the Middle East, it's just around the corner. I live in Nice. I'm an hour away from North Africa. We're not doing our part in a sense. And so my prayer would be that the Evangelical Church would go through a strong missional conversion and start actually blessing other nations to pay it back in a sense and to pay it forward.
Well, thank you so much for this, Raphael. It was really great to hear more about what is going on in your country with regards to the church. People who have comments, questions, or feedback can direct it to us by sending us an email. We're at podcast@christianitytoday.com, or they can go on Twitter @CTPodcasts, and you can find us there. This podcast is made possible by everyone who is able to support the Ministry of Christianity Today. And this is a big week for us here, in fact, because today is our last day that our CEO will be the CEO before we get a new CEO. And so as part of that, well, actually not as part of that, there's annual board meetings, but I know this was kind of like celebrated last week.
Yeah.
At the board meeting.
Yeah, it was a pretty special time. We were saying goodbye as a board. The board was saying goodbye to Harold Smith. He's been president for 10 years during a very difficult period. He entered his administration just when the recession hit, and he and the people who were in charge at the time had to make some very hard decisions in order to keep this ministry afloat. And now I think we're in a very stable, not only a stable, but like Raphael said, we are just thinking about ways to reach out globally with our ministry. So that's all due to his leadership. So it was interesting. We had at his goodbye dinner the previous president, Harold Myra, the current president, Harold Smith, and the future president, Tim Dalrymple, all together. The former two presidents laid hands on the new coming president. So it was one of those just bittersweet moments, but mostly a celebration of the past and the future that we're going to have. So
yeah, and we'll remember that today at this reception that we're having.
It tells you something
hours.
About the personality of Christianity Today, the fact that the former president and the current president and the future president can all be in the same room and actually look like they love each other.
Wow. And tell me about Mark, that Mark says they look like they love each other.
Well, what I mean is, I'm being facetious, but we know of many evangelical organizations which there is a lot of tension.
Or scandal.
Currently, or scandal, mm-hmm. or tension between the incoming and outgoing and all that sort of thing. And that is, we are fortunate to not to be in a good place right now.
We really are. I mean, we talk about this all the time, but half the shows that we do sometimes feel like they're about situations that could never happen like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, if you would like to support CT that way, you can do that by going to morect.com/podcasts, morect.com/podcasts. And we know that many of you give already, and we're really thankful for that. All right, now is the time of the show that we call Precious Moments, and everyone gets to share something that's brought them joy recently. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was in Denver visiting my newest grandchild, Julia, who's a month old. She was cute, but awfully sleepy, so didn't spend much time with her.
More fun in the future.
But got to spend some good time with my grandson on Monday while Morgan was nagging me about what we should do for Quick to Listen. We were at a theater watching Missing Link.
Good.
With popcorn in hand, and afterward went out for yogurt.
Wow.
And then went to Target to buy some Pokemon cards. It was just a 7-year-old's delight.
Which is probably your delight, too.
Yes, it was. It was a delight to see him so delighted.
And you don't see him as often as you see some of your other grandkids.
Right, exactly. So
I'm sure he was thrilled you could come out.
And it's also good to attend church with them to see their church situation. They're in a kind of a startup church. They rent a building and trying to reach out to the Denver, you know, younger generation. So it's very encouraging.
All right. Where can people find you outside of this?
I publish something called The Galley Report. It's a weekly newsletter in which I link to articles and comment on them. Many people find it interesting. You might want to check it out. Basically, what it boils down to is, what is Mark Galley interested in? And if you read it and you find that you are, you can subscribe.
Awesome. All right, Raphael.
Yeah, just come back from the Sahel. We spent, as a family, a week down in the south of Tunisia, and we were in the desert. And it was the first time I really had the chance to experience the desert, and it was beautiful.
So what did you do? Did you guys sleep outside in a tent, or you rode on a camel?
Yeah, right in the middle of a sandstorm. It was crazy. But it was beautiful to see actually how lively the desert is. You know, when we think about the desert, we sometimes think about death. But only a little shower here and there will allow you to see beautiful flowers coming out of the ground, out of nowhere. And it's very noisy, the desert. And so it's in those places that you can really listen to silence, but also to see the sound of rebirth. And to be able to experience that with my kids and my wife, it was just really delightful. And also to be able to live like the people in the desert. And like the nomads under the tent, and then eat local food and cook bread in the sand. It was just unreal and magic.
So what do they do? Do they drive you out to you need to
get you can walk. I mean, there's people crazy enough to actually do that by walk. But usually what you do is you go into a sort of a SUV which is designed specifically for those kind of conditions, and then it takes you about a full day to get to the middle of the desert. You have dunes that are just 20, 30 meter high, and it's just sand all around you. It's just incredible. And then you spend some time in a desert, and you go from oasis to oasis, and it's beautiful.
Wow. And my experience, I only spent like one day in the desert when I was in Jordan a couple years ago. The stars were insane. Like, you could see, I don't know, I don't remember ever seeing better stars than when I was in Wadi Rum.
Oh, it's magic. And because also the desert, it's such a biblical theme, it also allows you to relate more to scriptures in a sense.
Where can people find you outside of the show?
Well, they can find me on Twitter and Facebook, Raphael Enzenberger. We also have the rzim.fr website. That's for the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries in France. And of course, rzim.org, which is the overall global platform for Ravi Zacharias Ministries. So do check us out. And we have ministries globally in different regions of the world. And come and see us wherever, or if we are around one of your cities.
And spell your last name for people.
It's Anzenberger. It could be longer, but we chose to make it like this.
All right. My precious moment this week was, well, so it was my birthday, which was kind of a mixed precious moment.
I missed that. Sorry.
Well, now you owe
don't
me.
Don't travel so much.
Wow, I get victim blamed. All right, so my birthday, I had made plans to like hang out at the beach. And as Mark doesn't know, because Mark is like, oh, the weather was so bad in Colorado. It snowed on my birthday all day.
Oh, yeah, I read about that. Yeah.
So, no, we did not go to the beach. And not only that, but I like woke up not feeling well, which I usually feel well all the time. And so that was extremely frustrating.
That would be unusual for you. Exactly.
So I was like, this sucks. But whatever, it was still all right. One of the things that we ended up doing was there's this thing, I guess, that happens every year called Soup Disco. And it's an event that takes place around the world where they try to draw attention to how much food people throw away every year. And so they get all these donations of food from people, different grocery stores and restaurants. And then they cook it all up into, you know, really healthy, great soup and salad. And then they served a free meal. So we went to that and helped cook a little bit with all of that too, which was really nice and fun. And I learned more about this, like the catering place that was hosting it is apparently the most like sustainable catering place in the US, which is also interesting.
Yeah, my son-in-law is an avid dumpster diver, mostly because of the issue of waste. It is stunning what he finds in dumpsters in the back of grocery stores.
Yeah, and
how
also,
much good food is still good, but for one reason or another, stores are not allowed to keep it on the shelf.
Or, like, give it to their employees. Like, I mean, come on. That's right. Like part of the other thing that's so ridiculous. All right, well, that's a different topic for another day. People can find me on Twitter. I'm at MEPAYNL. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. You can listen to the podcast wherever you'd like, including Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by myself and Cray Allred, and the music is by Sweeps. We will see you all next week. Bye.